Okay, so I'm Jenna. I work at Food and Water Watch, which is a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. We're basically a consumer advocacy group and a watchdog organization with offices across the country working to ensure that all of our food and water is safe, affordable, and accessible. So today I'm going to be talking a little bit about, I have no relationships to disclose as well, a little bit about GMOs. Some of you may have heard of them as GMOs or genetically engineered foods. It's sort of a hot topic right now. There's a lot of debate around it. So just a quick background on them. They're basically plants or animals that have inserted genetic material to exhibit a desired trait. The most popular trait that's added into these crops is mostly our commodity crops, corn, soybeans, and cotton. And that would be herbicide tolerance. So that essentially is an engineered crop that can withstand the use of either one herbicide or multiple herbicides, so that farmers have an easier time of getting rid of pests on the field. The second most common is the insect resistance trait, which is when a pesticide is actually engineered into the plant itself. So every cell expresses that pesticide, so when an insect eats the plant, they immediately die, killing the insect populations, the pest populations in a particular farmer's field. And there's some other genetically engineered foods, the GE salmon, which hasn't been approved, but you may have heard of that in the news. And golden rice is a biofortified rice for use in the developing world that has extra vitamin A content. They were first approved in 1992, so they've been around for a little over 20 years. And since they were first approved, the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, has approved about 110 different traits, mostly in the same few crops, since, you know, the commodity crops. And this is just a look, like I said, the herbicide-tolerant trait is the real breadwinner. And recently, what some of the biotech companies who make these seeds have been doing is stacking the seeds with multiple tolerances to different herbicides. The companies that make these seeds also end up making these herbicides that they sell along with the seeds. So there is, you know, clearly a conflict of interest, and it's a moneymaker. I mean, that's one of the reasons that is the most common trait that's in agriculture right now. I mean, also, initially did help farmers a lot with their fields, the ease was extremely great for them. And then some of these other traits that you may hear some of the seed companies saying is that, you know, genetically engineered crops are meant to help agriculture more and to help feed more people, but those traits are actually not the ones that are getting onto the market. The ones that are these herbicide-tolerant crops. I don't know if you guys, I'm sure you've heard of Roundup. It's Monsanto's greatest herbicide, and the active ingredient is glyphosate, and I'll be talking a little bit about that, particularly because it is the one example that we talk about with GMOs a lot of being a really good tool that was used wrong, and then, you know, has created an additional problem with herbicides in the U.S. And elsewhere also. But so Roundup Ready crops are just the herbicide-tolerant crops created by Monsanto to be able to withstand this particular herbicide, glyphosate. And glyphosate is by all standards, a very good herbicide. It does a great job of killing weeds, mostly broadleaf weeds, which is most of the really tough weeds to kill. When they were first approved, Roundup Ready crops were approved in 1996. They really helped farmers out, and they ended up having to use fewer herbicides because glyphosate, they could just spray glyphosate all over their field, kill the weeds, and that was it. But as you can see, as years have gone by, that tool has become less useful, and they've had to spray more glyphosate on crops as years have gone on, and that's where the super weeds come in a little bit, too. So, like I said, this is just a slide from our report, which is called Super Weeds, and you can find it on our website. But total herbicide use since genetically engineered crops have been approved has actually gone up, which is not necessarily what the seed companies intended to happen, but it actually sort of works out for them too. And then glyphosate, like I said, has just been going up over the years. It's actually, since 2001, it's increased about 15 times to 2012. So we used USDA and EPA data for all of our charts that are in that report. So with the glyphosate use issue and what's been happening is that superweeds have been developing this resistance, weeds in general, because of the use of glyphosate year after year, crop after crop. Most farmers rotate corn and soybeans, and there are Roundup Ready corn and soybeans, so they usually just use Roundup every single year. And that's just a great situation for weeds. It makes for extremely rapid evolution of susceptibility to those herbicides. And so now what seed companies and have decided to do is to stack even more herbicide tolerances onto their seeds and spray more, you know, some of the more toxic herbicides that were approved back in the 50s that we've actually started to use less of onto these crops. So their use will start going up once these are approved. 2,4-D was just approved last month by the EPA. And the 2,4-D tolerant crops were also approved by the USDA, so that'll be on the market for next year, and it's really something that to be concerned about with our agriculture right now. Of the 9 crops currently pending approval by the USDA, half of them are herbicide tolerant, so it's really just the major, major GMO that you'll hear of. And this is just some of our analysis. We looked at some of the new old herbicides, 2,4-D and dicamba. They were around in the 50s. Their use there right now is fairly low, although 2,4-D has been going up in recent years since glyphosate has become less effective. And really, you can see there the increases in just a couple years if these crops, and if now that 2,4-D tolerant crops have been approved, these herbicides are likely to be sprayed more often and more times in the growing season. And I'm not the only one who thinks so. I swear there are other experts who say the same thing. David Mortensen is a well-known weed scientist out of Penn State University who has written about this issue and projects that about there will be a 70% increase in total herbicide use now that 2,4-D crops have been approved. And Charles Benbrook, a sustainable agriculture professor at Washington State University, has also done an analysis on this and found a 30-fold increase of 2,4-D levels once these crops are going to be approved. And the USDA even admitted to a, I think it was 4- to 6-fold increase in their environmental impact statement of the 2,4-D tolerant crops. It's not a secret that these rates are going to start going up, and then, you know, what will those impacts be on health and the environment? And this is just, these are those big 6 seed companies, like I said, they control over 70% of the seed market now. It didn't always used to be that way, but that's how it is now. And so a lot of them have these co-branded herbicides and also the genetically engineered seeds that they sell together for these herbicide-tolerant crops. It's a great money-making scheme. And this is it's since 1996, the sales of GMO seeds have gone up 150 times. So they're making lots of money from these crops and their associated herbicides. And like I said, superweeds, or these herbicide-resistant weeds, as you'll hear them called, have been really spreading across the U.S. If you talk to farmers in the southeast U.S., they are really, really struggling with glyphosate-resistant weeds, mostly Palmer amaranth and water hemp, which can grow to be 12 feet tall, and could have over 1 million seeds per plant that they just spread all over a farmer's field. It's really tough. Farmers have been resorting to hand weeding and hoeing their fields, which is something they haven't had to do in years. And as you can see, 1996 is when GMOs were first approved, and there were no glyphosate was being used since the 70s, but there were no glyphosate-resistant weeds until really the mid-2000s, and now they've spread across the states. It's projected, industry projections say that about 60 million acres of U.S. land are afflicted by glyphosate-resistant weeds. And weeds aren't the only things developing resistance to these crops. I mean, you also see a parallel here with antibiotic resistance. Antibiotics used prophylactically pretty much had the same result in animal agriculture, and now we're seeing it with these weeds and with these insects as well. Okay, so one of the other issues with spraying more herbicides, obviously, is the herbicide drift. 2,4-D and dicamba are very drift-prone herbicides, and that's one of the major reasons we're so concerned about it, not just for the environmental impacts and the human impacts of this, but also for agriculture, for organic and even conventional vegetable growers. 2,4-D and dicamba can really destroy a farmer's yield of tomatoes, grapes. All of you wine lovers, can be really tough. And so these are some of the human health costs of 2,4-D and glyphosate exposure. A lot of the research has been done by industry, but some of the non-industry studies have shown some very troubling impacts. They're both still registered by, both of these pesticides are still registered by the EPA, but you know, there are some, especially 2,4-D and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, that has been linked many times in several different studies. So that it's really something that could be more of a problem for you public health people in the future. And then also food residues. So if more and more pesticides are being sprayed on these foods, you know, we can expect that the residues will go up. What EPA and USDA have done over the years is just start to slowly increase the MRLs, the maximum residue levels, on the foods as the number of applications farmers need to make goes up. Whether or not that's, you know, scientifically sound is up for debate, but that is what happens. And actually, there was just a great GAO, Government Accountability Office, report out just 2 weeks ago that basically said FDA is not doing a good enough job monitoring these particular pesticides, glyphosate and 2,4-D. And then environmental costs, these are just a few things. There's a new study recently out about glyphosate and bee health, bee learning ability. You know, we all have a lot of, we're trying to save the pollinators, but we're having some issues with that with all the pesticide use. And then 2,4-D can be slightly toxic to freshwater and marine vertebrates, and dicamba has, you know, a lot of impacts on actual the flora and the fauna of field edges around farms. And the agencies that have been, you know, the ones in charge of regulating the pesticides and the foods, they're sort of disconnected. There is technically a coordinated framework, but it doesn't work well. The system is broken. When USDA looks at the crops, they're not necessarily looking at the increases in the pesticide use, and vice versa. EPA is looking at the pesticide use, but they're not looking at what the pesticide use will look like once the crops the herbicide tolerant crops are being used and what that will look like. So there really needs to be a reform of the regulatory system so that we can get a better, more precise look at what the real impacts to human health will be. And these are our recommendations. Like I said, the approval process and looking at the synergistic effects of all of these herbicides, now that they're being stacked more and more, what that is going to look like for human health impacts and for environmental impacts, and also for the actual superweeds, they have been starting to develop multiple resistance to these herbicides, which makes them even harder to kill, and that's why we need to come up with non-chemical alternatives, which might hurt the feelings of the seed companies, but unfortunately, we really need to help the farmers out in the field who are seeing these problems firsthand. And then finally, for Food and Water Watch advocates for mandatory labeling of genetically engineered foods, because otherwise, how will we know the processes that go into making these particular crops? And they're very pesticide heavy. So hopefully that was a good break from environmental health impact assessments. And if you have any questions, I'll be around after. So thank you.
Just want to take a moment to thank all our speakers. You know, I've learned so much about health impact assessment, and I'm sure all of you have lots of questions popping up, you know, across different geographic regions, but the theme is the same, and thank you for that pleasant which is very exciting topic. I'll open up the floor for questions. The only request I have is they would like me to record the questions for people, you know, who can attend the session. So if you want, you can come speak here, or I could repeat the question. Question is about the burden of assessment across various speakers. Let you address.
I'll talk about that from maybe. In terms of environmental health, this is a very common challenge, and there was actually a good poster on this recently, but finding ways to create, to equate local economic impacts and the health value around a particular concern. So you have, there was the demonstration that I had around that one particular company organization had done on the health potential health impacts of one power plant. I think it's something that, because it's maybe a relatively new field, there are a few researchers. Dr. Tassane from New York is doing this, trying to put an economic value on health. That, as a public health community, we can wrap our heads around that, but I think it's something that needs to be utilized more. It needs to be, EPA certainly uses it when they try to talk about the health benefits of a particular policy. It's hard for people to equate that, other than we know that healthcare costs are exorbitantly, you know, priced. So that was one challenge that we faced. But using the tools that we had, that's how we tried to equate economics and to get the buy-in from stakeholders at the local the community leader element to it. I think one of the challenges is that we have decision-making systems that separate, that are so siloed. Because, and this is changing in Kentucky, we're the biggest implementer of Obamacare in one of the most Republican states in the country. We just changed the name, and there was a lot of great buy-in because there was a lot of great need. So you have a system where suddenly the state is taking on healthcare costs, and we are paying attention to the fact that if we take on healthcare costs, we've got to figure out ways to reduce those healthcare costs, and we need to think about how environment affects those healthcare costs. So.
Thank you. That was a great correlation. Yes. Any other questions? Would you like to speak?
Yes.
Okay.
Fascinating stuff, Paul. I used to teach bioethics and public health ethics and environmental rights courses, and now I'm running an organization that does human rights impact assessments of things like aerial pesticides, spraying, agricultural spraying, roadside herbicide spray, and I think there ought to be health impact assessments done on all those kind of things. But nobody, the people who want them, they don't have any money to pay anybody to do it. So one of my questions is, who requested these health impact assessments? Who paid for them? Who are you who did them? Are you a private?
So the question was, who asked for HIAs and who does them, essentially, and from these projects? Tom thinks they should be done on all of this, and we agree as the practitioners. So it's interesting way, and I got up here because I'm the TA provider for both of these projects, which are funded through the Health Impact Projects, the collaboration of Pew Charitable Trust and Marwood Johnson Foundation, And that's a competitive application process. And part of what they look at to fund these is whether or not the decision maker, because so usually with an HIA, the decision maker is going to be separate from the people conducting the HIA. And you want to demonstrate buy-in from that decision maker that they're going to be receptive to what the HIA is going to say. So in Community Solutions instance, they're also the decision maker on the plan. So that indicated that, yeah, they were going to listen to what their own work was saying. In the Kentucky case, they had demonstrated a good relationship with the local health department, which then kind of opened the door, I would say, somewhat to the Tennessee Valley Authority as the main decision maker. And so that was identified as a high leverage point decision maker. And so that's how those were sort of funded through philanthropy to try and show demonstration projects of where HIA can be really effective in moving decision. And then in my case, it was written into the HUD sustainability grant. So the folks that applied for that, the sustainability group from Memphis that applied to it, realized that there was going to be a health dimension of this plan that they were doing. And so then they had a subcontract of this larger HUD project to devote a certain amount of funds to an RFP to do an HIA. So we applied for it and got it. And again, that showed willingness of the decision maker to be interested in hearing about HIA, because that sustainability office was the ones putting together this plan that had room for an HIA within the larger plan. And so I work at a health policy or a research center within a public university that functions kind of like a nonprofit consultancy, but we're university-based. So a certain, university-based HIA is about 30%. I'm trying to think of the pie chart you guys have. Roughly 20-30%. HIAs are done by academic institutions. A lot are done by local governments. In the Kentucky case, it's a nonprofit advocacy organization that's coming into this realm. And part of what we were trying to work with them on was to not be so strong advocacy focused, because the purpose being to sort of meet TVA where they are and try and have those conversations and show that, yeah, there are positives and negatives, and try and show that balance and work to convince them that they're not just coming in as the environmental advocacy group, they're coming in as, you know, the health and well-being advocates, and that there's pros and cons. I don't want to mischaracterize you, but is that roughly accurate?
Well, I think historically as an organization, we have tried to be a little bit more middle of the line. I think it's a very tough conversation in Kentucky. So I have recently presented health impacts of fracking at a oil and gas conference, and was essentially laughed because the person who presented on the same panel with us was talking about how environmental groups are destroying the image of industry. And so we now have how we have to compete with that. And our platform is, let's have a big conversation and not knock each other in the head. So that's a tough,
And then Community Solutions is our own, for-profit,
nonprofit?
Nonprofit community development group that, again, wanted to integrate this in their work. So HIA does come out of a lot of different perspectives, but often it has some kind of, a government support or a nonprofit kind of support. And there have been more and more. It's a small but growing subset of HIA that's really done by for-profit groups, also the planning and designs, the Habitat Health Consulting. They're a for-profit group that gets into this. But really, there's all kinds of different angles that you can come from. But really, the core piece is trying to find those decision makers that are interested in this, and that's one of our key points, is if a decision maker asks to have an HIA done on their decision, that indicates a willingness to hear what you have to say. So I don't know if that answers your question or just
sort of. I'm
opens the door for more.
Asking industry or whoever's going to be doing it to have buy-in on the process before it's done, because most industry wants nothing to do with health impact assessment. So I think the health impact assessment ought to be commissioned by a government agency.
And there are instances of that, and we could, please, get the Sophia flyer, and we could talk much more about it. Because that is a dialogue within our field of, should there be mandatory HIA, should they remain voluntary, and there are instances, Massachusetts is one, where any certain level of state-level transportation policy has to have some level of health impact assessment done on it. And that's somewhat of a successful model where they have the capacity to do that. It's still somewhat of an unfunded mandate, but they've got some good HIAs coming out of that. It's sort of one that jumped the ship with it is Prince George's County in Maryland. They have a requirement to do an HIA of any planning decision. And somehow that county level ordinance got passed with no resources, no funding, nothing. So now they have one guy that has to review every single planning decision, and he can't do an HIA of every one. And so there's certainly room in between those for improvement. But I think as a whole, the field would like to see it used as an optional and engagement tool that really builds dialogue. But you're right, in some instances, you want it to be mandatory. And we talk a lot about environmental impact assessments. You know, those are required. You know, NEPA, the enabling legislation for environmental impact assessment, is to protect human health. And that's something that's not in environmental impact assessments as much as it could be. So a lot of projects do have a legal basis to mandate more of a strong HIA or human health impact perspective into that work. So there's all different flavors of it. But I agree with you. A lot of these decisions could benefit from an HIA.
Let me extend one more comment on that. TVA was reluctant to engage with us initially, so we just went ahead and did it anyway. And then they decided that maybe it was a good idea to have a conversation. And the more they had the conversation with us, they were very generous with the amount of information that they shared. They opened up the power plant so that we could have dialogue. It's not exactly the way you're supposed to be. You're supposed to, you know, engage your stakeholders. It's kind of where you're dragging them into it. But I think industry is a prime example of you're not going to have willing a conversation unless you create the space for it. And I'm grateful that that happened. And I think it was because we took the very diplomatic approach we're not trying, this is not a mandate, it's a conversation. And they've been very open to conversation.
I was just going to add at the very, very local level and at the community organization level, we are not HIA practitioners. we learned as we went through the process. But it was a very useful tool in engaging the residents, the city agencies, other nonprofits, state agencies in the development of the sustainability plan. I don't know about the technical aspects of the HA. I think we did a pretty good job, but most people actually, not that they didn't care, but they were a little bit, it was sort of over their head about why this was important or what it was. But we used it, it was very helpful to use it as a tool and a framework to bring all the different groups together, understand why it's important, especially in the social determinants of health framework. And so, and there's some really good things that are coming out of it, actually, in terms of the work at Gully Brook.
Yeah, I think that was what we learned. I think for a while it was a little bit clunky getting through with residents and with community-based groups and even with the city and the state. But now that we have an HIA report, it's all clicking, and it's really bringing health to the beginning of a conversation around neighborhood transformation and neighborhoods of concentrated poverty. And I think for us, that's really important in terms of using it as a tool, again, to kind of bridge these gaps and create conversations where there were none that puts health kind of in the center. In our instance, it completely, all the decisions made along the way were because of the health impact assessment and because we integrated it from the beginning. It was very challenging. I'm not going to say it was easy. It was sort of putting two weird, big processes together and trying to explain to people what that looked like and why we were doing it. But so all of the recommendations that we have are outcomes from the HIA. So for us, it was 100%. Was really exciting.
Which is, quote unquote, easier when you're the you're the community developer and the HIA person. So in the Memphis context, that's again a thing we call it impact evaluation of HIA. Is did you really change those decisions and get those outcomes? And unfortunately, we don't have the time or the funding. It's the way it works. You can't really follow up on that. But I do know from our work within the Memphis context that there have been new partnerships between. Different hospitals in West Memphis and in Shelby County and the Sustainability Office have now actually started collaborating on funding applications and things like that. Some of the sub-plans, which is a whole other dimension of this, in the Fraser neighborhood area, it wasn't specifically a recommendation from our HIA, but as part of that process, we got out in that community and I think there's success in just giving them the venue to talk about their concerns in this regional plan context and saying, we don't care about getting new parks. We want the people we have now to have a place to play. And, we had a woman stand up in that community meeting and just start crying and yelling at us. And, she had not had the opportunity to do that in a setting. And so just by nature of the HIA taking place, we made a space for that conversation to happen and maybe got that room of community leaders more involved in, you know, the green space planning for their neighborhood that came out of this broader regional plan. So, you know, there's certainly room for more follow-up in HIA about actual impacts and what really happens in those communities and to those decisions. And I know there's some good work going on in Detroit that you could participate in.
I'll just add a couple of outcomes. We had some good conversation with the superintendent of schools that agreed to implement a program to include looking at air quality index to inform the activities of the children. So on a bad air quality day, the superintendent said, yes, we'll look at the air quality index. It's a bad air day. The kids that are identified with asthma will have to follow the doctor's orders. So that might be making sure that asthma, the inhaler's on hand or restricting outdoor play. That was a really great basic outcome. Another was putting up a sign for fishing advisories. Apparently it's gone up and come down and gone up and come down over the course of time. I'm not sure why people are scared of the signage. There's a lot of vandalism. So we counted those both as successes.
This is a question for the Community Solutions team. I was wondering, what was the time frame of the project and the challenges you faced getting from phase one to phase two?
Spring of 2013 to last week. Literally. And what was the second part of the question?
The challenges to get from phase one to phase two.
So I think, and Anna kind of touched on this before, I think the biggest challenge was a little bit around trying to work with stakeholders and residents on an abstract concept and an abstract concept. And then with Community Solutions being a first time, doing an HIA for the first time. So there are kind of three things coming together. You know, a neighborhood sustainability plan isn't something that everybody automatically say it and they know what it is. I think health impact assessment isn't necessarily when you say in a room of, residents and community-based organizations that they know what it is. And then, you know, Community Solutions is not a practitioner of HIAs by training. So I think that was the biggest thing, was really kind of continually trying to fit all those pieces together. And then again, doing it in a community development context, which really had never been done in the way in which we were doing it. So I think those were frankly the challenges. But I think what we decided or kind of what we talked about on the other side is that there's a great benefit as this moves forward, to continuing to think about ways that the process can be refined and be more inclusive, so that other folks in sitting in our seats, if we can get funding and get them baked into the beginning parts of big community development projects, that there's a great a need and an opportunity to include that health piece in community development work.
Why they wanted to support our project was they really see in the future.
feature that it needs to be implemented at the beginning of a project plan, program, or policy, and not sort of after it's done. So the movement, it's moving towards that.
Might be sticking around if anyone has questions.
Thank you.